Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Dean Ornish. Dean Ornish, MD, is founder of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, clinical professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, and author of 7 best-selling books, including his latest written with his partner, Anne Ornish, Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. Dr. Ornish's 42 years of research have proven that the lifestyle changes he recommends can improve heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and prostate cancer, and can lengthen telomeres, which begins to reverse aging on a cellular level. The Ornish program was the first lifestyle-based program to be covered in the history of Medicare. Dean has been recognized by Life magazine as one of the 50 most influential members of his generation and by Forbes as one of the 7 most powerful teachers in the world. So now, Dean, we're so glad to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad and colleague, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that introduction. And thank you, Dean, for once again being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure and a privilege, actually, to have you. Your work has been of the essence in bringing about the growing awareness of the power of simple lifestyle changes to prevent and to reverse the progression of the most common chronic diseases, often even without drugs or surgery. Now, in your latest book, Undo It, that Ocean just mentioned and that you've written with your partner, Anne, you say that lifestyle medicine is now the most exciting movement in health and healing today, that it's a tidal wave that hasn't yet even begun to crest. Why do you say that?
Well, because it's true. lifestyle medicine is a field that I helped create, which uses lifestyle changes not only to help prevent disease, but often to treat and sometimes even to reverse it. And it's by addressing the underlying causes of why we get sick, which to a larger degree than I think people had once realized, are the lifestyle choices that we make each day. What we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise we get, how much love and support we have, or to reduce it even further, to eat well, move more, stress less, and love more. And the more diseases we study and the more underlying biological mechanisms we look at, the more scientific evidence we have to show how powerful these changes are and how quickly they can often cause improvements that we can measure.
Well, many commercial insurance companies are now covering your program. And what's remarkable to me is that some of them, at least, are covering it not only for reversing heart disease, but also for reversing type 2 diabetes, for high blood pressure, for obesity, for elevated cholesterol levels. The list is growing. And it's inspiring to me to see how these same lifestyle changes can actually reverse so many different chronic diseases and how quickly the benefits can occur.
Well, that's true. And so in the Undo It book that my wife Anne and I wrote, and we've worked together for now 20 some odd years, we put forth this new unifying theory, which is that I was trained, like all doctors, to view these diseases you mentioned, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, obesity, early stage prostate cancer, perhaps dementia, autoimmune diseases, as being fundamentally different diseases, different diagnoses, and different treatments. But I've come to believe that, as I was looking back over our 43 years of research, why is it that it wasn't like there was one set of diet and lifestyle changes for reversing heart disease, which we're able to show for the first time in a randomized trial, or type 2 diabetes, or these other conditions we mentioned? It was really the same for all of them. It kind of hit me in a kind of what, in retrospect, may seem like a blinding flash of the obvious, that the reason why these same lifestyle changes are so powerful is that these diseases are not really so different from each other. They have more in common than they have different, because they all share the same underlying biological mechanisms, things like chronic inflammation, changes in the microbiome and telomeres and gene expression, overstimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, changes in angiogenesis, apoptosis, immune function, and so on. And each one of these mechanisms, in turn, is directly influenced by what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise, and how much love and support we have. To me, the best ideas are the ones that seem kind of obvious in retrospect, but no one had really talked about them before. It also helps explain why you often find that what are called comorbidities, the same person will have heart disease and type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol and be overweight and so on, because they're really just different expressions of the same underlying mechanisms. And again, why these same lifestyle changes can be so powerful in addressing such a wide variety of chronic diseases, both in reversing and in preventing them.
You mentioned comorbidities, diseases that occur alongside each other or together, almost as a package. We're hearing that term, comorbidities, a lot these days, because it's been found that people who have comorbidities along with COVID-19 fare much worse with the disease, with the virus, than people who encounter it but are healthier to begin with. Does your program help people to not have the very conditions that we're finding predispose people to bad outcomes with COVID-19?
They do. I mean, as you've indicated, the people who are most likely to die from being exposed to the coronavirus or getting sick from the coronavirus are those who have chronic diseases, the ones we've been mentioning. And so most of the focus so far has been on preventing exposure to the virus, which of course is very important, staying at home, social distancing, washing your hands, gloves, disinfectants, and so on. But very little, relatively little, has been written about the other half of the equation, which is, first of all, how to reduce your risk of getting these chronic diseases or to reverse them if you have them, and also how to enhance your immune system so that if you are exposed, you can reduce your chances of getting sick or at least to mitigate the intensity of the disease. And, some people have very mild cases and some people die from it. And the chronic diseases really are a big factor in that. And, the four aspects of our lifestyle medicine program, eat well, move more, stress less, love more, not only have been proven to reverse a wide variety of chronic diseases that often predispose to someone having bad outcomes if they get COVID, but also they enhance immune function.
Dean, it's telling to me that the same diet and lifestyle that you've proven can prevent and reverse heart disease and prostate cancer and many, many other of the serious conditions that plague so many people today can also greatly lower your risk of having a bad outcome with COVID-19. We can forget that the virus is not the only pandemic we're facing. Last year in 2020 in the U.S., more than 650,000 people died from heart disease, and another 600,000 died from cancer, and another 300,000 died from the obesity epidemic. We've gotten so used to so many people dying from what are actually preventable diseases that we almost take it for granted. And right now, thanks in no small part to the food we're eating, there are huge numbers of people who feel lonely and isolated and depressed. 40% of Americans are suffering from a chronic disease associated with a poor diet and lifestyle. And all of these people are at a much higher risk of death and at a much higher risk of other serious adverse outcomes if they become infected with COVID-19, which to me points once again to the incredible importance today of eating a whole foods plant-based diet. You can dramatically reduce your risk of all of these problems, and you can greatly lessen your risk of a bad outcome if you do become infected with COVID-19. Dean, I've heard you say elsewhere that when we're depressed, our immune systems are depressed. I know you've done a great deal of research into how our diet and lifestyle can affect depression. In your research, did you find that depression scores were significantly decreased when people ate a whole food, plant-strong diet? And did the other simple lifestyle practices that your program entails?
Yeah, we found that depression scores were decreased by 50% overall, and in some cases even more. That's actually better than you get with antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft and other SSRIs. And we weren't really trying to address depression. We were just doing the same intervention, which generally improves health and well-being. But, I think the real epidemic or pandemic is not only heart disease and diabetes and, of course, COVID, but loneliness and depression and isolation. There's been a radical shift in our culture in the last 50 years with the breakdown of the social networks that used to give people a sense of love and connection and community. 50 years ago, most people felt connected. They had a neighborhood that they grew up in and they knew their neighbors and saw them regularly. They had two or three generations of families living together in the same neighborhood. They had a church or a synagogue or a mosque or a club that they went to regularly. They had a job that they'd been at for 10 years or more that felt secure and stable. And so they got to know their coworkers. And many people today don't have any of those things. And you say, well, we get connected online. But, you know, one study which we talked about in the Undo It book showed that the more time you spend on Facebook, the more depressed you are, because it's not an authentic intimacy. What makes intimacy healing is that you're seen in all of who you are, not just, you know, I mean, the thing with Facebook or Instagram or these other things is, or WhatsApp, is that it looks like everybody has this perfect life. But, you know, here we are in front of the Eiffel Tower, or here we are, our son's graduating college. You know, most people don't post their failures, their demons, their dark sides, you know, the things that we all experience. But if you grow up in a family with two or three generations of people living together, they know you. They don't just know your Facebook profile. They know where you messed up. They know where you got busted, or, you know, you had a nervous breakdown, or your kid got on heroin, or whatever it happens to be. And so I think that anything that in our support groups that we use in our studies are not just to help support people in staying on the diet, which is what people usually think about, or exercising, as important as those things are. It's really trying to replicate that experience of being fully seen by focusing on what's really going on in your life, which somebody could say, you know, I may look like the perfect parent, but I'm really not. My kid's, you know, whatever. He's failed school, or he's on heroin, or whatever, you know. And somebody else can say, gosh, you know, that must be awful. Or gosh, you know, my kid's having problems too. Or I'm having problems too, you know. And it doesn't change the fact that the kid still is whatever, but it changes everything in terms of the shame and the guilt and the sense of being seen and fully regarded. And that often can give people the power and the motivation then to go back out and be a better parent, or be a better father, or be a better spouse, or whatever that happens to be. And so, you know, we tend to focus on things that we can measure. And yet sometimes the things that are the most powerful are the ones that are the hardest to measure and yet the most meaningful.
In your new book, Undo It, that you wrote with your wife, Anne, you quote an ancient proverb that says, when diet is wrong, medicine is of no use. When diet is correct, medicine is of no need. Now, Michael Pollan, a very widely read author, is famous, among other reasons, for his saying, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And now you've come up with a variation on that, which is that in order to reverse most chronic diseases, eat real foods, just plants, not too much sugar or fat. Dean, can you help our listeners to understand why a whole foods, plant-based way of eating can reverse the progression of so many chronic diseases?
Yeah, and Michael's a good friend, and I think he's right on when you're talking about preventing disease. You know, it's the ounce of prevention and pound of cure. It takes a lot to reverse a chronic disease. That's why we were the first to be able to show that from a research standpoint in so many cases, because most people didn't go far enough. And yet, if you're just trying to stay healthy, what matters most is your overall way of eating and living. So I wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Spectrum, which is really based on preventing disease, as opposed to the newer book, The Undo It book, which is really more about reversing disease. And in The Spectrum book, the point was that what matters most is your overall way of eating and living. If you indulge yourself one day, it doesn't mean you cheated or you're bad. You know, eat healthier the next. In fact, the language of behavioral change has this kind of fascist, moralistic, you know, finger wagging, you know, nurse ratchet kind of quality that really turns a lot of people off. Because even more than being healthy, most people want to feel free and in control. And as soon as I tell somebody, you know, eat this, don't eat that, do this, don't do that, they immediately want to do the opposite. That's just human nature. And when I, you know, lecture sometimes, I say it goes back to the first dietary intervention, you know, when God said, don't eat the apple, and that didn't go so well, and that was God talking, you know. So to me, the lesson is even more than being healthy, but we want to feel free. And so if you're just trying to stay healthy, instead of saying, eat this, don't eat that, once you call foods good or bad, it's a very small step to saying I'm a bad person because I eat bad food. You know, at that point, just might as well finish the cheeseburger because you're a bad person. You know, that doesn't work very well. And so in the Spectrum book, I categorize foods from the most healthy group 1 to the least healthy group 5, as opposed to saying these are good foods and these are bad foods. Now, the group 1 foods are the whole foods, plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products, the usual suspects. Group 5 are the usual unhealthy suspects, you know, fried foods, donuts, red meat, things like that. And groups 2 through 4 are intermediate. And I say, look, instead of me telling you what to do, what do you want to accomplish? Oh, I don't know. I want to lose 10 pounds. I want to get my cholesterol down. I want to get my blood pressure, my blood sugar down. I want to whatever. You say, good. What are you eating now? I'm eating mostly unhealthy group 4 and 5. Great. How much are you willing to change? Wow, no one's ever asked me that before. Everybody's telling me what to do. That's kind of cool. I like that you're asking me what I'm willing to do because now it's my choice. Okay, well, I'll eat less of the 4 and 5 and I'll eat more of the groups 1 through 3, but I'll indulge myself sometimes. Okay, great. How much are you exercising? Not enough, but how much are you willing to do? Well, I'll walk a half an hour a day. Okay, that's good. How much meditation and yoga are you doing? Zero. How much are you willing to do? Oh, I don't know. I'll do 20 minutes a day of meditation. Cool. How much love and support do you have in your life? Not enough, but I'll spend more time with my friends and family. Great. So we'll support that degree of change. We'll track it. And then after, you know, a month or 6 weeks, we'll recheck everything. And let's say they wanted to lose 10 pounds and they lost 5, or they wanted to get their LDL cholesterol down 40 points and it went down 20. Say, great, look at that. You're getting better. Now, if you're willing to make even bigger changes, again, not all the time, but most of the time, you can probably get the rest of the way. And then I just find that's a much more sustainable approach because no one's telling them what to do. It's very empowering.
Dean, I get that people vary in how much they want to change. And if you're only wanting relatively small improvements in your health, then you can often accomplish those benefits by making some simple changes. But Dean, one of the things that always fills me with awe is that people, if they're willing to make significant positive changes and stay with them, they're very often able to reverse even conditions that are immediately life-threatening. It's not always easy, but it is quite possible.
If you're trying to reverse a life-threatening condition, it's hard. And that's what the Undo It book is about. And it's about, you know, what it takes to actually reverse disease. And we're finding that in all of our studies, there was a dose-response correlation between the degree of lifestyle change and the degree of improvement at any age, which was really, I had thought incorrectly that the younger people who had milder disease would do better, but it wasn't how old or how sick they were. The more they changed, the better they got at any age, which is a very empowering message. But to get reversal, they had to follow the program pretty close to 100%, which is basically a whole foods, plant-based diet, meaning it's essentially a vegan diet, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products, that's also low in fat and sugar, walking for a half an hour a day or an hour 3 times a week, or some kind of aerobic exercise and some strength training as well, some resistance training, an hour a day of meditation and yoga, which is a lot for many people, and the support groups. And as you say, Medicare and many insurance companies are now covering the program. They're now even covering it virtually. So we're making it available virtually as well, which makes it much easier for people. And it's working. You know, we're getting bigger changes in lifestyle, better clinical outcomes, bigger cost savings, and better adherence than anyone's ever shown. And the reason it works is that our bodies have, in many cases, a remarkable capacity to begin healing if we just stop doing what's causing the problem. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of protective substances in fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and so on that have anti-cancer, anti-heart disease, and anti-aging properties. But it's also what they're not doing, that you get really a double benefit when you go on a whole foods plant-based diet. You're not only not consuming the things that promote disease, but you're also getting hundreds of thousands of others that are protective.
Well, there's a belief today, it's widespread, that we've been told to eat less fat, and we're eating less fat, but we're fatter than ever. So the low-fat diet recommendations were wrong. And according to this thinking, our problems really are due to sugar and refined carbs, and that's the end of the story. Dean, it is true that we've been told to eat less fat, and it is true that we're fatter than ever. So what's really going on here?
Well, it's true that we've been told to eat less fat, but actually, if you look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture database, which actually tracks not what people say they're eating, but what they really are eating, that they are fatter than ever. You know, we are eating more fat, more sugar, more calories, decade by decade since 1940 when they started tracking these things. So it's not surprising why we're fatter, because we're eating more fat. But there's this reductionistic thinking that it's all sugar, or it's all fat, or it's all meat, or it's all stress, or it's all smoking, or it's all lack of exercise, or it's all whatever. And it's not all any of those things. It's a multifactorial condition. Each of these things is important. That's why, you know, we have 4 components to our program. You know, the eat well, move more, stress less, love more. They all play an important role. So an optimal diet is low in fat and low in sugar and refined carbs. It's mostly plant-based, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and so on. And again, it's not just the diet, but these other aspects as well. And so the study is showing that, for example, if you go on an Atkins-type diet, you can, or which is now kind of, you know, morphed again as a ketogenic diet or a paleo diet, it comes in different forms, is that they're all based on the half-truth, which is that most Americans eat way too much sugar and refined carbs. And if you eat less of them, that's a good thing. But it's what you replace them with that really matters. If you replace them with, you know, I'd love to be able to tell people that bacon and pork rinds and sausage and so on are healthy, but they're not, you know. But if you replace them with good carbs, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes as they come in nature, then you get a double benefit.
Dean, I know what you mean when you say that you'd love to be able to tell people that bacon and sausage are healthy, because people love to hear good things about the unhealthy foods they like to eat. But I think it's much more important to do what you do, which is to tell people the truth. Dean, a lot of people really like eating pastries and donuts and white bread. Can you help our listeners to understand why refined carbs like sugar and white flour are bad for them?
The reason why refined carbs like white flour are bad or sugar is that they get absorbed very quickly from your stomach into your and your gut into your blood. And so your blood sugar spikes really quickly. Your pancreas makes insulin to bring it back down, which is good. But the insulin accelerates the conversion of calories into fat. It promotes inflammation, which is one of the mechanisms that underlies this unifying theory that we were talking about, all these conditions. And you can consume virtually unlimited amounts of sugar without getting full because you've removed the fiber that would otherwise fill you up before you get too many calories. You can only eat so many apples, you're going to get full before you get too many calories. But when you eat whole grains, you know, whole wheat flour and brown rice and, you know, fruits and vegetables as they come in nature, they're rich in fiber. The fiber fills you up before you get too many calories. And it also slows the absorption from your gut into your blood. So instead of getting these rapid spikes in blood sugar that provoke an insulin response, and over time, those insulin surges desensitize and downregulate the insulin receptor. So you get your body's making more and more insulin to get the same effect. And that's what causes what's called insulin resistance and then ultimately metabolic syndrome and even type 2 diabetes. But when you eat whole grains and fruits and vegetables in the natural form, the fiber slows the rate of absorption. So you don't get those rapid rises in blood sugar. And therefore, you don't get those repeated surges of insulin, which cause the downregulation and the insulin resistance and the inflammation. And then, but you're also getting the hundreds of thousands of other substances that are good for you. And you're not getting the things that are bad for you. It turns out that animal protein, independent of the whole fat versus carbs debate, is harmful as well. And there was a wonderful article in the New England Journal of Medicine years ago by Stephen Smith that had this beautiful picture, which I reproduced in the Undo It book, about what happens in your arteries on different diets. And on a diet like I recommend, the arteries are open and clean. On a standard American diet, the SAD diet, in every sense of the word, they're partially clogged. But on the Atkins, paleo, keto diet, even though your blood sugar may go down, the arteries are severely clogged. And that's why, you know, when Dr. Atkins died, his autopsy was released to the public and it showed that he died of heart failure. You know, that just because you can lower your triglycerides or your blood sugar doesn't mean it's necessarily good for you. And what really matters is what's happening in your arteries.
Dean, sometimes people go on a keto diet and they lose weight or their blood sugar numbers come down and they're excited. But I hear you saying that even with these short-term improvements, their arteries are becoming increasingly clogged, which leads to more heart attacks and strokes. Dean, do we have evidence of what happens to the arteries of a person eating, say, a single meal of even high-quality meat compared to what happens to the arteries of someone eating, say, a single meal of wholesome plant foods?
You know, there's a wonderful documentary called The Game Changers, I'm sure you've seen, that Luis Cihoyos and James Wilkes and others did, that is still the number one most downloaded documentary in iTunes history, just to show how much interest there is in that. And there's a great scene in there where first they drew blood on athletes after a single, you know, high animal protein meal, high fat meal, and then a plant-based meal, and then showed how the blood was really cloudy after the single high fat meal and was clean and clear after the healthier meal. But they did another scene, which has become almost legendary now, where they had three elite athletes in their mid-20s, and they had them eat a meat-based burrito. And then at night, they had this device that they put around their penis to measure how frequently and how hard their erections were when they slept at night, which is a normal guy function. When you sleep, you know, at different times during your sleep, you have erections. It's kind of how your plumbing keeps healthy. And then they did the same thing the next night with a single plant-based meal, also in a burrito. And they found that after the plant-based meal, they had 300 to 500% more frequent erections and 10 to 15% harder erections when compared to the single meat-based meal the night before. And apparently the film crew went on a plant-based diet after shooting that scene. It shows so many things that are so powerful, that are so motivating, because so often people are, again, coming back to fear. They're saying, you know, eat your vegetables, you know, you'll live longer. Or, you know, am I going to live longer? Is it just going to seem longer? You know, I want to have fun. I want to enjoy my life. But, you know, if you say, wow, you know, if you eat this way, your sexual function improves. Would you rather, and some people say, you know, I like eating cheeseburgers, but I like having sex a lot more, you know, or, you know, for athletes, they have all these elite athletes who raised their game and became NFL champions, the NFL Titans won their first championship ever, and Olympic athletes, medalists at the age of 39 and so on. How quickly the athletic performance improves.
It seems that everyone's functioning improves with a whole foods plant-based diet. Athletes, as you mentioned, have faster recovery times and so can train harder and often perform better. People have far lower rates of disease and they have much more vitality, emotional resilience, and joy in their lives. And I find it extraordinary that the same food choices that provide all these benefits to our lives and to our health are also vastly better for the earth.
As you know better than anyone, more global warming is caused by livestock consumption than all forms of transportation combined. And also more deforestation of the Amazon. It takes 14 times more resources to make a pound of meat-based protein than animal-based protein. There's really enough food to feed everyone. Nobody really ever need go hungry. But it's more of a distribution issue if everyone were to move towards eating more of a plant-based diet. And, you know, not to mention that these are, you know, billions of sentient beings are, you know, put in crates that they live their whole life in and then are massacred. And I, you know, sometimes it's so easy to say, like, what can I do as one person about global warming? You know, it just seems like such an overwhelming thing. And if we understand that something as important as what we put in our mouths every day can make a meaningful difference, I find that if it's meaningful, then it's sustainable. My son is 20 and he's a really accomplished musician. And there's an indie band called Wolfpack that he likes. And we went to their concert and the front man is a vegan. And we ended up going backstage and said hello to him. And he said, hey, in the middle of our concert, would you come out and say a few words about why eating a plant-based diet is a good thing? I said, what did you just say? You want me to come out in the middle of your concert and talk about why eating a plant-based diet is healthy? He said, yeah. So it was at the Greek Theater in Berkeley. And there's like, you know, 18,000, you know, mostly millennials. And so for 15 minutes, I was cool to my 20-year-old son. It didn't last, but at least for a short time, talking about these things. But I didn't talk about heart disease and diabetes and prostate cancer, because when you're 19 or 20 years old, you know, you can't relate to that. You think you're immortal, you're going to live forever. But I talked about global warming and I talked about feeding the hungry. And I say, you know, something as primal as what you put in your mouth each day can free up resources to feed the hungry, to reduce suffering, to reduce global warming. Even if it's just a meatless Monday, you don't have to be a vegan. Just, you know, to the degree you move in that direction, what's good for you really is good for the planet. Then that can, you know, it was very well received. And I got the feeling of why people like to be rock stars, being on stage with thousands of people screaming good things at you is a good thing. But again, it's really what motivates us is if it's meaningful. And if we realize that we're not powerless and there's a lot that we can do. And sometimes something as simple as what we eat can make a meaningful difference around the world.
It is amazing how much difference we can make to the quality of our lives, to the level of vitality we experience, and to some of the great issues of our time, such as reducing hunger and addressing climate change with our food choices. Dean, are there also economic implications to all of this?
86% of the $3.7 trillion we spent last year on healthcare, which is mostly sick care, was for treating chronic diseases that are largely and often preventable and even reversible through these same lifestyle changes we've been talking about. It also turns out that 5% of Americans account for 50 to 80% of all healthcare costs. And these are the ones with chronic diseases as well. We did a study with Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield years ago showing that in the first year, they cut their overall healthcare costs by 50%, and four times fewer people did they spend $25,000 or more on the year after they changed these lifestyle. Because, and we did another study with Mutual of Omaha, where they saved almost $30,000 per patient in the first year, because almost 80% of people who were told they needed a stent or a bypass or an angioplasty were able to safely avoid it by changing lifestyle. And it's important to show cost savings in the first year because they know that a third of people change jobs every year, and with that, they change insurance companies. And insurance companies say, why should we spend our money for some future benefit that someone else is going to get? But if we can show cost savings in the first year, which is when you really show this to treat disease and not simply to prevent it, then the cost savings are in the first year. And then so if it's a self-insured corporation, those savings accrue to their bottom line. If it's an insurance company, they go to their bottom line. And then it becomes really just good economic sense to do this as well. So whether you're looking at it from an economic standpoint, a animal suffering standpoint, a global warming standpoint, a better sex standpoint, you know, looking better standpoint, you know, it all converges and like, oh, these are really the things to do. And not to live longer, although you probably will, but to live better, which is really what makes them sustainable.
You know, there are so many benefits and advantages to the program that you're advocating, have been advocating for a long time, that you've proven can reverse most chronic diseases and certainly can prevent even more. It sometimes boggles my mind that there's resistance. There's so much resistance to this. And some of that resistance is coming from the medical profession. I've always thought it's kind of a scandal almost that nutritional education isn't taught in medical school. Most of our practicing physicians haven't learned anything about it. And yet people go to their doctors assuming that their doctors will have some expertise in the relationship between food and health. How is that happening? And what's your take on it?
Well, you know, it's that old saying from Abraham Maslow, if the only tool you have is a hammer, you tend to see everything as a nail. And we're trained to use drugs and surgery. We're reimbursed to use drugs and surgery. And so we use drugs and surgery. You know, that's why I spent 16 years of my life to work with CMS to create a new benefit category to cover our program for reversing heart disease. In the early 90s, through my nonprofit institute, the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, we trained 53 hospitals and clinics around the country for almost nothing in our program for reversing heart disease. And, you know, there were academic centers at UCSF and at Scripps and Harvard and Beth Israel, New York, and in community hospitals in Omaha, Des Moines, Columbia, South Carolina, you know, et cetera. And we worked. We got bigger changes in lifestyle, better clinical outcomes, bigger cost savings, and better adherence than anyone's ever shown. And yet a number of the sites closed down, which was shocking to me. Like, why would you do that? They said, well, this is the best program we've ever had of its kind, and it's not reimbursable. So if it's not reimbursable, it's not sustainable. So that's what set me on this 16-year journey with Medicare, because I knew no matter how many studies we did, if it wasn't reimbursable, it would always, you know, be a footnote. And it's not because, you know, we doctors are only interested in money, but if you're trained to use drugs and surgery and you're reimbursed, then that's what you do.
Dean, do you see this changing? What do you see on the horizon?
I think that this is a wave that hasn't even begun to crest, because there really is a convergence of forces that make this finally, after so many decades, the right idea at the right time. Because on the one hand, the limitations of drugs and surgery are becoming increasingly clear. There are now two 10-year randomized trials of men with early stage prostate cancer, and they showed that only one out of 50 actually lived longer when they had surgery or radiation. The other 49 really didn't, and often got, you know, worse side effects of, you know, being impotent or incontinent or sometimes both. In the case of type 2 diabetes, getting your blood sugar down with drugs doesn't work as well at preventing the horrible side effects of or sequelae of diabetes, you know, amputations and kidney failure and blindness and impotence and heart attacks and strokes. But getting it down with lifestyle, if you get your A1C down below 7, according to the American Diabetes Association, you can prevent most, if not all, of those complications. In the case of heart disease, there are now at least 8 randomized trials showing that stents and angioplasties in stable patients really don't prolong life, prevent heart attacks, or even reduce chest pain. Whereas we've shown you can reverse it through simple lifestyle changes at a fraction of the cost, and the only side effects are good ones. And so, and not to mention the costs that we talked about earlier, the economic costs of this, as well as the human costs. So I'm optimistic by choice. You know, I'm not optimistic by nature, but I'm optimistic by choice, because I've been, you know, I was suicidally depressed when I was in college. It's very easy to get depressed by all these things, but then you just can't really function. But if I choose to be happy, you know, I feel like I have a lot more choice in that. That can be self-fulfilling in a good way, but it also gets me out of bed every day and helps me to do the kinds of things that hopefully can make a difference in the world.
Well, you are, in an enormous sense. I was thinking about a friend and colleague of yours and mine, Kim Williams, who, of course, is a former president of the American College of Cardiology. And at one point in his career, he realized that his cholesterol levels were very high, his other blood markers were too high, and he began to study the literature to see what he could do, because he had not learned anything in his training as a cardiologist about diet and how that might help. And he found your work, and he began to undertake your program, and he got enormous results. And as a result of that, he's become a leading spokesperson, to say the least, for the health advantages, particularly the cardiological health advantages of a whole foods plant-based diet. And I think his life and work and his mission now are another example of what you're talking about, which is that we're seeing changes. Things are happening that are making it possible now for more and more people to understand and to take advantage of the benefits that they can themselves receive and gain from a whole foods plant-based diet and the other lifestyle actions and choices that your program so beautifully includes.
Well, it's true. And I think he's a wonderful example of that. When he was the president of the American College of Cardiology a few years ago, he held a keynote session at their annual scientific sessions in Chicago. And over 3,000 cardiologists showed up for a seminar on lifestyle medicine that included me and Kim and a few others. And they were turning people away at the door. And so I realized that there is a real hunger for this information.
There is a real and growing hunger for accurate and credible information about the proven benefits of a healthy diet and lifestyle. Cardiologists and other physicians want this information, and so do people who want to reverse disease conditions by correcting the underlying causes rather than just trying to suppress the symptoms by taking drugs that invariably have side effects and don't get at the underlying causes. Dean, what is the significance of lifestyle medicine for you?
I think that lifestyle medicine for me is a way of being able to function as a real healer, to really help people deal with the underlying causes, which are lifestyle related. But even the lifestyle choices themselves are often functions of deeper issues that are a result in many ways of the depression and the sense of loneliness and isolation that are truly pandemic in our culture, with the breakdown of the social networks that we talked about earlier. I mean, I'd ask people, and we've talked about this in our prior interviews, but it's worth repeating that I'd ask people, you know, in our studies, because we'd really get to know each other well, we'd live together for a month at a time or, you know, meet regularly for years at a time. And I'd say, you know, teach me something. Why do you smoke, or why do you overeat or drink too much or work too hard or abuse opioids or play so many video games? These behaviors are maladaptive. And they look at me, they go, they're not maladaptive. They're highly adaptive. You just don't get it. They help us deal with our loneliness, our depression, our pain. One person said, you know, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes. And they're always there for me and nobody else is. You're going to take away my 20 friends? What are you going to give me? You know, it's not like they don't, it's not like it's not on every pack of cigarettes. It's not like I say, hey, Mr. Jones, I want you to quit smoking. Did you know it's bad for you? And they go, wow, I didn't know that. Thank you so much. I'll quit tomorrow. You know, everybody knows it's bad for you. But the question is, why do people do these things? And my spiritual teacher, Swami Satchidananda, for many years, an ecumenical teacher, would always say, there's always a causal chain of events that leads to something. And the farther back in that chain you can go, the more powerful the healing can be. And so if you just focus on the behavior, the information, well, that's important, but that's not usually enough. If you focus on the behaviors, that's better, but still not enough. But if you focus on the cause, then people are much more likely to make lifestyle choices that are life-enhancing than ones that are self-destructive. I mean, I've had people say things like, food fills that void that I feel in my heart, or fat coats my nerves and numbs the pain, or video games numb the pain, or opioids numb the pain. We have this huge opioid epidemic, or, you know, drinking alcohol numbs the pain, or other drugs numb the pain, or working all the time distracts me from my pain. You know, it's more socially acceptable, but serves the same function. And so by focusing on the deeper issues, which we don't learn that much in medical school, and yet they're harder to measure, and yet often the most motivating and meaningful, I think then we can really function more as healers than as simply as technicians. And that can make the burnout that's so prevalent in medicine, the real antidote to burnout is a sense of meaning that comes from really being able to empower people and not just to, you know, treat them as, you know, giving them pills and operating on them. And I remember years ago, I'm looking out on my wall, this guy, I was running this thing called the Beta Breakers Race, which is a very San Francisco tradition, you know, about where you got the serious runners and then you got people like me who just go out for fun. And then you got people who run naked or in costume or whatever. And around mile five, I was getting kind of tired and looking for an excuse to slow down. And I saw a guy lying face down on the ground on the pavement. And I said, that's a good excuse. Let's see what's going on with him. Didn't have a pulse, did CPR. Another guy came and did CPR together. Someone brought up a defibrillator, got his heart started. He ended up having emergency bypass surgery that saved his life. And then he went through one of our programs to keep his arteries open. So, you know, drugs and surgery can be life-saving. You know, when I saw this guy on the ground, I didn't tell him to eat broccoli and meditate. But once you get people stable, then that's where it really begins, not where it ends. That's where we then need to, you have their full attention. There's a receptivity to change when someone is suffering. Suffering can be a real doorway for transformation. But unfortunately, we often, whether in medicine or in life in general, see suffering as something to be numbed and killed and bypassed literally and figuratively rather than as a way of getting our attention. Because, you know, change is hard. But if you're hurting enough, then the change becomes more appealing. And then because these biological mechanisms are so dynamic, when you change, you feel so much better so quickly in most cases. In the case of someone who has heart disease and they have angina or chest pain, when they can't walk across the street without getting chest pain or make love with their spouse or play with their kids or go back to work without getting chest pain, and usually within a few weeks they're pain-free, then they say, okay, yeah, I like, you know, doing bad things to myself, but boy, I feel so much better. What I gain is so much more than what I give up. It makes it sustainable and worth doing.
When you talked about the guy who you found face down in the race, I was thinking about a friend of mine, a woman whose husband some years ago was in a race and had a heart attack during it and was rushed into surgery, and they saved his life. And she went through this real scare, of course, afraid that she would lose him, which she didn't at that time because of the surgery that was performed. But he didn't change his lifestyle. He didn't go through an Ornish program. And less than a year later, he had another heart attack, and this one was fatal. And my friend did lose her husband. And I keep thinking how important it is for people to understand that we really do have the power to control our health in our hands in a whole lot more than we realize, a whole lot more than we've been taught, a whole lot more than is generally believed in our culture.
Well, it's true. And I'll tell you a funny story. I did my core surgery training as a medical student with Michael DeBakey, who was one of the pioneering heart surgeons who really basically invented the procedure. But he would tell people after he had operated them, he'd say, you're cured. And then more often than not, they would go home and, you know, eat the same junk food and smoke cigarettes and not manage stress and not exercise. And all too often their bypasses would clog up and we'd cut them open again and sometimes multiple times. And for me, that became the metaphor. We were literally bypassing the problem rather than treating the cause. Anyway, fast forward to about 3 years ago, decades later, probably four decades later, and I got this call. I said, hey, Dean, this is Mike DeBakey. And he has a very distinctive Louisiana accent, which I recognized immediately, even though I hadn't heard from him in literally decades. And I said, hello, to what do I owe this honor? He said, well, remember those ideas of yours that I used to give you such a hard time about when you were my medical student? I said, oh, yeah, I remember very well. He kind of said, that's what's kept me alive all these years.
Wow.
He was 99 years old and he died a few months later. He said, I just wanted to let you know that before I passed, because my wife got really interested. He remarried and his wife got really interested in all these things, and he just wanted to let me know that. So if you live long enough, you know, but it's kind of changed my whole event horizon about, you know, change takes time sometimes. And I think things are moving in a good direction, just not as fast as I would like. I used to get into friendly discussions with Al Gore when An Inconvenient Truth came out. I said, you know, you can scare people for a while and get them to, you know, buy less polluting cars and fluorescent lights and whatever, LEDs. But, you know, telling people the world is going to melt down in 10 years, we're all going to die, is just so staggeringly horrible that people can't hold that thought for very long. And so they just tune it out. And that's true. And when you tell somebody, you know, you got to quit smoking because you're going to get lung cancer, you got to change your diet because you get a heart attack. It's just for a month or so, they'll do pretty much anything that their doctor or nurse tells them, but then they stop doing it because fear is not a sustainable motivator. What's sustainable is joy and pleasure and love and feeling good and altruism and compassion. What Aldous Huxley called the perennial philosophy, which you find in all great spiritual paths and religions, once you get past the the rituals that people fight and kill each other over all too often. Because that's really where healing, in my limited understanding, is at its most profound. Even the stress management techniques that we use are really not just about managing stress, you know, because they weren't developed by the ancient swamis and rabbis and priests and monks and nuns to manage stress. They certainly do that. They're really very powerful tools for transformation, to quiet down our mind and body, to experience more of an inner sense of peace and joy and well-being, and to realize that's our natural state, is to be healthy and happy most of the time until we disturb it. So then the question becomes not how can I get what I need to be happy, but how can I stop disturbing the peace that's already there? And the great irony is that not realizing that's already there, we often run after, gee, if only I had more money, more power, more beauty, more accomplishments, whatever, then I'd be happy. Then I wouldn't feel so stressed. Then people would love me. Then I wouldn't be so lonely. Once you set up that view of the world, it generally turns out badly, because until you get it, you feel stressed. And if someone else gets it, then you feel really stressed. And even if you get it, it doesn't last. You know, it's either now what, it's never enough, or so what, big deal. And so if anyone's listening to this and you do anything like meditation, or if you're a religious prayer or yoga or whatever it is that quiets down your mind, and when you're feeling more peaceful, to remind yourself that the technique, the meditation, for example, didn't bring you a sense of peace that you didn't already have. Rather, what it did was to help, at least temporarily, to stop disturbing what's already there. Now, that may sound like splitting hairs and, you know, parsing words and semantics, but the implications are profound, because if we get our peace and our health from outside ourselves, then everyone who has what we think we need has power and control over us. But if we say, oh, I've got it already, what am I doing that's disturbing that? And often, ironically, it's the thing that I've got to go get something to be healthy and happy. And in the process of running after those things, I disturb what I could have already. Then that's very empowering, not to blame myself, but to empower myself, because then I can do something about that.
Well, your work has empowered so many people. I consider it a privilege to be your friend and colleague.
Me too.
And thank you. On behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the food revolution, I want to thank you, Dean, for your outstanding work, your deep commitment to the healing of our lives and our spirits and our bodies and our world, and of course, for being with us today.
Well, it's a deep honor and a deep pleasure. And if people realize that this is the most fun way to live, that's the most erotic, the most pleasurable, the most exciting, the most adventuresome way to live, that what you gain is so much more than what you give up in every way, and certainly the most meaningful way to live, then it becomes much more sustainable for everyone. So deep bow to you and to Ocean for your pioneering work and for giving me this opportunity to be of service, and I hope it's been useful.
We've been talking with Dr. Dean Ornish, founder of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, creator of the Ornish diet, which has been ranked by U.S. News and World Report as the number one diet for heart health yet again in 2021, and author of 7 bestsellers, including Undo It, How Simple Lifestyle Changes Can Reverse Most Chronic Diseases. Dean, you might be the most influential preventive medicine advocate in world history. We are so grateful for you and for the work you've done and for your leadership and for your science-driven wisdom and for your huge heart that imbues everything you do. And we are so grateful for your partnership in the food revolution.
Deep gratitude to you both. Thank you so much.